Welcome to Max Planck Florida Institute's Neurotransmissions Podcast. Today your hosts are Misha Smirnov, Ben Scholl, Joe Schumacher, and Matthias Lubert.
Hello out there. Today we are sitting here with David DiGregorio. He's a director of the unit of dynamic neuronal imaging at the Institut Pasteur in Paris, France. Welcome, David.
Hello, thank you.
It'd be awesome if you could talk a little bit about what exactly you study and why you're interested in the cerebellum at all.
Well, the cerebellum is a very interesting structure that's often left out of discussions about how the brain works. And so it's becoming a great place to start exploring. Classically, we've used it because it has a very well-arranged set of neurons, which are the elements of the cerebellum that we think are mediating communication and information transfer and processing. And so it makes it very easy to study from a kind of practical and experimental point of view. And for the longest time, we just used it kind of used it for that reason. And now we're realizing more and more that, in fact, we're able to study how all of those elements can transform information. And that means we can say something about what it might and how it might relate to behavior. And so that's given us the opportunity to examine more precisely how neurons can actually mediate behavior. And so we think it's a great model system to understand which is one of the principal goals in neuroscience now, is the neural basis of behavior. Mm-hmm. And so we think it's a more tractable system. And at the same time, it's rather interesting because there's been a lot of recent experimental evidence on humans and kind of not direct evidence, but curious evidence that in fact the cerebellum might be implicated in psychiatric diseases, in particular autism spectrum disorders, even dyslexia, and even schizophrenia. And these are all diseases, and the symptoms that are thought to be related to cerebellum are the multisensory, the ability to process information from the different senses. It's one of the principal regions of the brain. There are a few others in which that is its critical function, is to process information from different senses. But that's a big question, and that's basically a hypothesis, and that's what we're working on now, is to see if that's actually likely and if the cerebellum really has a huge implication in those diseases. Mm-hmm.
But it's not like there's the motor cortex, which is a part of the cortex, right? And we have the somatosensory cortex. And, you know, recently there's been kind of these hot news items where we found people, I think there was a woman in China most recently, that they found that she had no cerebellum at all, right? So can these people behave normally? Can they adapt to not having a cerebellum? Or what kind of deficits do they specifically show?
I think I've just read a little bit about that, but as I recall, they have a significantly delayed language acquisition. They have a significantly delayed even some intellectual, and they do have some not so normal social behavior. And so I think it's kind of funny. On the one hand, people argue that, why do we care about the cerebellum if these people still live normal lives? They're hardly normal. I mean, I think people would normally say, wow, there's some deficits there, but the deficits are subtle. And so that's, I think, one other aspect of the cerebellum. And I didn't even introduce the classic reason that the cerebellum has been studied, is to study motor movement, right? It's for motor control. But when we think about motor control, it's actually not controlling the big parts of movement. It controls all the fine details. So it's the ability to precisely, you know, for example, sports are probably thought to really engage the cerebellum quite actively because you have very precise movements that are necessary. And so that's the type of thing that you can extend the same logic to even more cognitive behavior, that there is fine details that are needed to have proper social interactions or language skills. And all of those fine details can be tweaked and adjusted by cerebellum. So everything that you have, it's not completely lost when you don't have the cerebellum like you would other structures, but you lose that fine tuning. So you lose what you normally expect from a normal behavior so that's just gone. And so you get these huge delays and potentially even some long-term cognitive deficits. But it's true, they're still alive, they walk around. They're not well known to being sports, high-level athletes. So that's I think that's the way to look at it.
Actually, on touching on that, maybe we could just step back a second. And since you didn't really, I mean, you just said it there, but maybe you could elaborate a little bit about what kind of behaviors the cerebellum is sort of known for that would make it a tractable source for many psychiatric disorders.
Yeah, so the principal model that we think about the cerebellum is the ability to predict sensory consequences to actions. So the idea would be, for example, if I need to know whether I'm moving my arm and then create kind of a sensory response on my arm versus me being moved by a car or something and having the exact same sensory response, you need to know what's the difference between the two. And the key thing that your body does is it says, well, my brain told my arm to move. So if I kind of know that piece of information at the same time that I had my sensory response, I know how to deal with it. I know what actually the sensory, my perception of the sensory response meant. And in fact, one of the things that we think the cerebellum does is to actually eliminate expected behaviors. So the idea would be is that I don't really care about the fact that I felt wind on my hand when I moved it, but I do care about the fact that there was wind on my hand when it wasn't me who was moving it, and I need to know that I'm moving by somebody else. And so that's a classic example of what the cerebellum might do, which is to kind of cancel expected sensory behaviors. And that's useful, that kind of model, that computation is useful for many other things in the brain, or at least that's what we think. And you can imagine this is the same type of prediction that needs to occur if you want to make a decision about something, and it requires, there's kind of a, people talk about having an intuition when they make a decision. Well, part of that intuition is kind of subconscious, and part may come from your cerebellum's ability to process a complex sensory environment and to a certain extent eliminate kind of the unwanted kind of sensory stimuli that exist, that's happening. All of your senses still have them, but you can't pay attention to them. And that's analogous to what some autism spectrum disorder patients express, which is the fact that they have hypersensitivity to different sensory stimuli, and therefore they can't get rid of them like they normally would, which is why we have this kind of circumstantial evidence that maybe the cerebellum could play a role even in such diseases. So this is kind of, these are the current hypotheses that we're really actively working on exploring.
The feedback mechanism that you mentioned, how important is it actually to have this feedback during development? What are the differences between people that actually were born without a cerebellum or lose it in earlier days compared to those who lose it as adults due to injuries, for instance, in trauma?
That's a great question. I don't know a lot about this, but there are specific studies that I can answer that if you don't have your cerebellum, a damage to the cerebellum early in life will lead to a great increase in the chance of having autism. So that clearly shows that it's important, at least in functioning with the rest of the brain, for establishing the final circuits. You don't have the same deficits when it happens later in life. Okay, so it doesn't mean that you don't have any influence on cognitive behavior, but the circuit has been able to be set in such a way that then you can handle that loss later in life. But it seems to be critically important early in life. So that's one of the clear. And then we're still examining like how long that critical window is and even what are the deficits that still might be there in adult.
I have like a random thought that maybe you thought about. I'm just kind of curious. I mean, is it not funny to you that, I guess not funny, but like, or interesting that the idea of predictive coding as we've evolved seems to have extrapolated to use this insanely massive structure relative to other creatures. Insects and invertebrates have come up with lots of beautiful ways, even sometimes with a single neuron, to do predictive coding. So it's mind-boggling to me sometimes thinking about how we've, as humans, have evolved away from that to a much more complicated system with many more neurons and many more synapses, and why that might be the case.
Yeah. That's a great question, and it brings up many different kind of curious issues. The first thing that's really interesting about the cerebellum is that it's a wonderful little tidbit, but I think it tells you about what it's doing, which is that over half of the neurons, in fact, they've estimated in humans 70% of the neurons of the brain are cerebellar granule cells. So these are the principal cells in the cerebellum that we think are actively participating in integrating these multiple senses and then making a prediction about the sensory environment. I think the way to look at it, and the other detail that we know, is that the size of the cerebellum through evolution has co-evolved with the neocortex. So the parts of the brain that we think make us most human, that have gotten larger, the cerebellum has also co-evolved, and in particular, those parts of the cerebellum that receive connectivity, or has connectivity with the neocortex. So it seems like the more that you need to compute, you always need to have some I would even call very simple system, because I think at the level that the cell types are simple relative to other parts of the brain. So it's a very organized system that's just purely dealing with correlations and its ability to correlate everything. And in fact, it was originally, that principle was originally inspired the machine learning strategies that are now used by Google, for example, which is this idea of deep learning, which is that you can use a very simple algorithm, and if you teach it correctly and you have enough information, you can learn anything. Well, I think that's kind of what the cerebellum is doing. It's thrown a lot of neurons at the problem. It has it, therefore, the more things you need to compute and think about, and which is what we think happens in, you know, when humans has evolved these increased brain capabilities, you had to at the same time increase these predictive abilities. Otherwise, everything would be too slow. Mm-hmm. So in fact, you mentioned feedback before. So actually, it turns out we think of the cerebellum as feed forward, right? It's making a prediction. It doesn't need response back so that it can do things both fast and kind of at a massive scale. And that's why it has to continue to grow and you have so many things. And in fact, for the electric fish is another thing, is the electric fish also have a cerebellum. So they have a cerebellum to handle the normal cerebellum stuff of organisms, but they also have this additional structure to handle this very specific problem, which is that every time they swim, they activate their electrosensory organ, which would be a false signal in their regime. And so they realize that they had to compensate for that. So it does seem like throughout evolution, in order to solve problems that organisms are come across and to have proper behaviors, you have to have this kind of parallel system that helps fine tune, because it's not possible to do it with the current limits of, you know, the other structures themselves, like just neocortex alone. But a neocortex alone can do a lot of what you need to do. It's just that you don't have that ability to fine tune if you don't have the cerebellum.
Mm-hmm. So in the meshing between simplicity and complexity, I guess the simplicity of the cerebellum is essentially the stereotyped cell types, right? You've
exactly.
got a handful of cell
and
types and a ton of them. So the complexity then, I'm guessing, is coming from the massive, massive, massive possible number of connections and computations that could be done.
Exactly. And I think, and we have hypotheses still, which is that it's even wired up randomly, so that if you mix, I mean, you have some biases that you will want to connect certain types of sensory behaviors that are related to a certain behavior. But at the same time, it's still combining many, many different possibilities in order to handle all the different unpredicted, you know, unknown correlations that may exist. So I always use the example. So, for example, in your tennis swing, you don't really care whether or not your pinky toe really hurts. But sometimes, actually, it can really throw off your game. Right. So in normal tennis, you don't care about what your pinky does. But when it starts hurting, somehow it can actually discoordinate everything. So at some point, there's an information that's getting combined somewhere. And we think that the cerebellum's capability to massively consider all these different options, different sensory features, is a part of that role. But this is really just a hypothesis I want to emphasize. But that's a way of us for thinking about its role.
Mm-hmm. So one of the examples I was taught when I first heard about like the concept of a forward model, which is what the what you're describing in the cerebellum, is that if Michael Jordan took a jump shot, he typically would know with some degree of certainty whether it was going to go in or not before it ever hit the basket. Like, so there was some kind of combination of the feel of the motor motion and watching it in the air. And so what's nice about a forward model is that you kind of have this online consistent error signal that doesn't require a delayed feedback thing. But you think about other types of behaviors where you don't necessarily see the outcome of the behavior until after it's happened. You have this very delayed feedback signal. So in those two contexts of behavior, it seems like there's different time scales where information is important. Is there anything about the cerebellum where we know the time scales over which sensory and motor information are integrated and maybe become important that's different in other types of motor behaviors?
That's a great example. And I think that the time scales of when the cerebellum is working in its optimal learned regime, so you've learned a behavior like the jump shot, he knows exactly almost in real time, and he may not even be consciously, his body knows how to even micro adjust and to make sure that it does the same thing every time. And that's what we, that's what the cerebellum is best at, which is to perform computations on the tens to hundreds of millisecond time scale. And, you know, it's also famous, for example, pitchers, when they pitch in baseball, they let go of the ball, I think, within less than a 10 millisecond window. Because if they don't let go at the right time, the ball, just given the angles and things, just goes off into no man's land. So it never even comes close to the plate. So the precision with which they actually throw the ball is amazing, and has this kind of this temporal precision that is right striking. And that is something that can be learned and implemented and guided by the cerebellum, because it can work on that time scale. Now, the question about this feedback, like visual feedback. So a classic is, I grew up playing golf, and I like golf a lot. And it always requires you hit, and then you look, and you say, oh, that wasn't good. So, but at some point, then there's a memory of all the motor motions that went along with it. And what you tend to do is you start matching result outcome with the feel. And that is how you kind of optimize. And so I think that there is, what we don't know is how that cognitive realization feeds back to the cerebellum as some sort of guidance and air signal. So that's what some people are now exploring, because it is on a completely different time scale. And it's a very interesting time scale, because it's very relevant for humans. So it's going to be a challenge to also get rodent models in which we can do the same studies, where we can study more easily. But it's a fascinating question. And at some point, it's still thought to be, at the final fine tuning is cerebellar dependent, but we don't know how that feedback actually works, which is really interesting.
So that's basically why my golf swing is terrible, is that, like, I'm overthinking the outcome, and I'm developing superstitions about how to position my
Absolutely.
Body and stuff.
Yeah. So it always helps to have someone tell you what that one motion should be, so you can feel the right feeling that's associated with the right result. But if you've never learned that, then you're just trial and error. And it could take forever. And that's your cortical trial and error.
Right.
Cerebellum trial and error is much more efficient.
Right.
I was also going to make a joke.
I'm not joking. I'm really bad at golf.
So you mentioned the pitcher. If we take a look from the other side, from the hitter, how does it correlate there? So the hitter doesn't really have the time to process, okay, the ball comes in at a certain angle, I have to hit it at a certain spot. How does this work?
It's all the same. We have a part of cerebellum that's completely dedicated to seeing visual motion. And so everything is already built in the cerebellum to exactly execute that. Now, practically, I have zero intuition. I could never hit a baseball very well. And I was always afraid it was going to hit me. So I probably had some sort of fear signal that was also distorting any sort of realistic computation in my cerebellum. So I never really managed to hit something very well unless it was going very slow. But I imagine that when people do it, like anything else, you develop the association between small cues that they are able to pick up and probably start to pick up even subconsciously. And that's how it allows them to be precise hitters. It's just, you know, I think at some level, the cerebellum is a great example of practice makes perfect.
And then, but everything we're talking about, right, it's, you know, whether we're talking about basketball or golf, it's all some kind of motor dependent stuff. And even language, right, we're still talking about creating noises and moving our lips and so on. But you mentioned, you know, people with cerebellar disorders a lot of the time have various cognitive deficits. And I don't know if this is too speculative, but do you think is it specifically that the cerebellum is involved somehow in the pathway of cognition? Or is this a side effect of, well, you know, if you can't form speech or communicate very well with other people, or that these disorders tend to be comorbid with other brain disorders?
That's a little bit the million-dollar question, in fact, about whether cerebellum is really, really involved and how it might be involved. And I think that one of the things I like to think about, and this is a great forum for discussing ideas, which is that if you don't form an accurate picture or perception of the sensory world, it can have many different consequences, whether it's a moment-by-moment decision-making, which does involve some subconscious biases, a value, and ability to estimate value and what you will want and how you will achieve a decision in order to meet that value. I think it's this ability to create the right context, which is involving internal even emotions. So there's feedbacks with emotional parts of the brain to cerebellum. So it's all about seeing that context correctly and then developing an appropriate response to it. And so in some cases, it could just be that, yeah, they're just overwhelmed with all of the information, and then that makes them frustrated. So it's kind of really the social effect is really a result of not having the correct sensory impression. That we don't know, and that's kind of a disconnected. In other cases, they could be more intimately related, which is that you need the right context in order to make the right decision or to be able to have the right social interaction, which is more intertwined. So we don't know how distant related, or just that you have cerebellar deficits that run in parallel with the real social deficits, and there's actually no link. I think those are the kind of the three possible kind of categories that people are actively exploring and using psychophysics experiments on humans, as well as now we're trying to study kind of the circuit mechanisms to see how that might also lead to understanding this better. So
you explained to us nicely about the function of the cerebellum and what it actually does. But what are the techniques that you actually use to study the cerebellum?
Our approach to study the cerebellum at the moment is to try to understand how it. So we have a model of how we think the cerebellum might work that was originally given to us by Marr and Albus and has been modified since then. And these were the guys that first came up with the idea that is now based on deep learning. So it's a computational model. And now we're actually using that as a guidepost to say, okay, there's the cells that hook up to the synapses that connect the information between the neurons. Mm-hmm. Do they actually do what the model says? And that's what we've recently shown, that in fact there's some basic elements that seem to agree with that model, so that the computation using the math to help guide us what could be computed. And so the idea now is to start measuring in animals that are actually performing tasks and or at least receiving sensory stimuli, and monitoring the cells using advanced microscopy techniques in which we can look at the activity of neurons by what is called two-photon microscopy, and we can actually now follow their activity. So we've characterized the connections are basically fitting the model. Now we need to follow the activity and see how the model is working in real time in a real behavior. And then that will really help us understand getting back to the original point, which is how the neurons relate to a behavior, which is what my lab is best at. How that's going to help for autism is going to require actually the same studies, for example, in autism mouse models, which can be a useful insight, but of course has to go along with many, many other experiments that link, done in humans, for example, to really understand how it might relate to autism. But at least for the neural basis of behavior, these experiments allow us to understand how single cells relate to a circuit behavior and then ultimately to the behavior of the animal.
So since we've talked a lot about the general aspects of the cerebellum and the circuit dynamics and the code, and as you've mentioned in your lab, you're looking at different aspects from the synaptic structure to modeling with computational models. I might be asking a loaded question here, but is the cerebellum using a rate or a temporal code? We've never discussed this before on the podcast.
Explain that to the listeners a little bit.
Perhaps you might do a better job at explaining what the difference is. I mean, in terms of these are sort of fundamental things that neuroscientists think about and have maybe argued about for generations.
Yeah, I think so. When we talk about coding, it's so this idea. So we know that neurons fire; they have signature electrical events that occur in 0 or 1. So it's kind of convenient because it keeps it simple. And then they happen a certain number of times per second. And so the question then becomes: are things about the sensory environment encoded in the number of these electrical events per second, or are they encoded into kind of the time evolution? In other words, if they kind of start to increase slowly and then decrease quickly, and then therefore that is somehow a signature. So it's somehow not the absolute rate, but the exactly when that electrical signal comes. And I think it's the simplest answer is as time gets shorter and shorter and shorter, rate, which is the number of literally the number of electrical events per second, as you get too short, kind of becomes irrelevant. And so I think it becomes, if the behavior is on a time scale of 100 milliseconds, then the coding scheme must be on a time scale less than that. And therefore, rate is not always a good approximation. And so in particular, what we found is that, in fact, just as observations, us looking at our own brain, realize that we could see and identify what particular sensory stimulus was activated by looking at the time of the first electrical event. And that's technically a time code. And so it's interesting that that's a very oversimplification, but could represent the fact that there's useful information kind of in all of the parameters. So the evolution of rate and even the first time of a spike. So in the cerebellum, because it works on this 100 millisecond timescale, the processing we know occurs on this timescale is likely to use at least time coding as temporal coding, as well as probably weight coding, depending on the different stimuli.
Yeah, I mean, I guess realistically, it's potentially a mishmash between the two. But in particular, you know, it gets to, at least for me, it gets confusing because, for example, the example you used earlier with baseball, you said that you might be releasing the ball, the motor commands involved with that might be on the order of 10 milliseconds, which is so fast that you can only assume that it must be some kind of temporal code that's guiding that. However, when you look, we first talked about the entire hierarchy of the circuit. So you have this insane number of neurons that have this very high dimension of possible connections. And so when you see that network and you're like, well, there's billions of possible connections here and everything is heavily multiplexed, how is it possible that you maintain a temporal code with information being fed in? It just seems mind-bogglingly impossible.
Yeah, no, it's a fair enough. If you think about it just in terms of numbers, but the key thing is to follow this, which is why it's a forward model, is that actually everything is done in parallel. So all those, that's why you need all of the granule cells, is because you can then process this in parallel. So in fact, there's not too many. So the way we think about how neurons will relate to timing is the number of synapses, because each synapse adds a certain number of milliseconds in delay. So the more synapses you have, and as you were kind of alluding, if you have cross connectivity and connectivity backwards and forwards, and then yes, things then evolve on a much slower timescale. But because the cerebellum doesn't have too many feedback components to the circuit, that it's largely this forward synapses, and there's not too many of them, you know, on the order of one muscle, two or three synapses before it leaves the cerebellar cortex, that's going to allow you to do things on a fast timescale. But then you need all of the neurons to do all of the kind of sensory combining. So in a way, that's all of the neurons allows you to have the speed, provided that it's wired in this kind of parallel process.
So you take that information, you split it up into millions of channels, and then you reconverge it back into the single channel real quick.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why you also have this unique Purkinje cell, right? Yeah. Which has this enormous number of inputs, 100,000 inputs. So it's 100 times what a cortical neuron might have. So it's really a unique circuit that really seems like it's designed to do machine learning, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of funny. Machine learning came from its original anatomy, and now we use machine learning to understand what that anatomy is doing. So,
and I mean, just to dwell on this for one more second, but in computers that do machine learning, they have internal clocks that sort of keep track of all the different computations. So when it comes to maintaining that millisecond precision or that 10 millisecond precision in the cerebellum, is there an internal clock, or like Purkinje cells acting as internal clocks to sort of make sure that things don't get screwed up on the output?
I think I have to say I don't know on that. But I do know there's a lot of, so there are 200 hertz oscillations that can sync up with cortex. So it doesn't need to be its own clock. So it can be something that's clocked by like cortex, which would make more sense because the cortex needs the information on a certain time regime, but it doesn't. But the cerebellum doesn't know when to provide. I mean, it'll provide an update when it's told to. So it kind of the fact that they can oscillate together, cortex and cerebellum, makes it to me that the clock may be elsewhere. But
so it may just,
I go back to my first answer, which was I don't know.
I'm glad. Well, look, we had to stump you at some point. So.
So Santiago Ramón y Cajal, who's considered to be the father of modern neuroscience, was the cerebellum was very central to Cajal's work. It informed him on the propagation of information in a neural circuit, and maybe aside from the retina, maybe that was the most informative for him. Flash forward 70 years or so, when Marr and Albus's multi-layered perceptron model comes out that you alluded to earlier. Were they going strictly on the anatomy that was known? Because it's hard to imagine that in 1970, a lot of the really fine scale circuit level electrophysiology had been done at that point.
No, they were so what we did know is the connectivity, the basic numbers. We knew that there was, you know, sensory information would come in along one information path, an axon, what's called a MOSI fiber, and it would touch up to 1,500 granule cells. And we knew that at some point, all those, and that there were a lot of granule cells. So again, this is this number of at the time they knew there was a lot of them. They didn't know that it was, you know, over half the number of cells in the brain. But then what they also knew is that all of it somehow converged through a lot fewer Purkinje cells. So they could do just, they could count the numbers per little piece of tissue and make an estimate about what the connectivity ratios were. And that's what they took to there. It's like, well, what do you do with this? What is this? What can this do? And they knew one other detail that was critical, which is that each granule cell receives only 4 MOSI fibers. So they had these like critical numbers that are not easily definable in other structures, which allowed them to then build a model, say, what on paper, what is the what does this tell us about the math this structure can do with some simple assumptions? And then it's amazing, it still took us to just recently to know that, in fact, for example, that the sensory, which is critical for their assumption, was the sensory inputs were actually mixed onto a single granule cell. That was actually a critical parameter in their model that no one had ever tested till recently. So it's kind of funny, you're right, the fine scale didn't come till now. They just guessed and said, well, it could do this. And it's not until recently that we're starting to show that it indeed probably does that.
Which I think is a good example of like a really interesting interplay between theory and experiments. You start out with like Cajal's very basic observations. You basically distill it down into an equation on a piece of paper as best you can. And then it pays off in the end when somebody can observe that math mm-hmm. going on in the brain.
Absolutely.
And you do a lot of modeling. I mean, in your talk yesterday and in your most recent paper, there's some integrating fire neuron stuff. So what do you see as the benefit of coming up with these types of models? Are they purely explanatory, or do you like to see them as generating predictions for how circuits might be working?
Yeah, I definitely prefer the latter. So generating predictions, it's kind of almost a pun, I suppose, as well, if you're studying cerebellum. But yes, I mean, I think that's really, it's what I call the formalized hypothesis, right? So if you put it together on a piece of paper, seems to work, it's kind of like it works kind of like on first principles. Then you need to say, what does this predict? This predicts X, do we see X? And I think it's a little bit more analogous to, I think, how physics and theoretical physics interact with each other, right? So you can make a theoretical prediction and then you're looking for data to support it. And it's not so much that you're supporting a theory or not. It's really about making a hypothesis that you can test to drive knowledge going forward. And then in some rare cases, and actually one of the cases is the collaboration with Sam Myung, the model is the only thing that's providing insight to a structure that we haven't quite measured yet. So it's someday we'd still like to measure it, but sometimes you need to make a prediction. It's like, I really don't know what's going on. And if you add all of these different processes and nonlinearities together, what does it tell me? And so far, if I've made all of these measurements, I can say those for sure, and then say, well, the physics says that the outcome has to be in this range. And sometimes that's sufficient for a moment, but ultimately it always should require a feedback of a testable experiment in the future. And I think that's how science moves forward, and that's what we look for, and we love to have these as bench models, is what we call them, in hypothesis driving structures. So
well, I'd say we would all like to strive to be a scientist like you.
I don't know about that.
Well, I mean, I find that is the best place to be, obviously, to have a model, and then particularly that model, right? Like, you don't have the observation yet, so you're sort of making the prediction, forcing you to do the experiment when you can in the future. But I do feel that in many cases we're often stuck in the middle. Like, we collect some data from some question that we had, then we use a model to sort of better understand it and describe it. That leads to a further question that we then probe second. So it's sort of an intermediate combination of the two aspects, as opposed to sort of pure model predict, hypothesis driven model predicting an outcome that you have to measure. So, and that's one of the best parts about being a neuroscientist.
Actually, and I have to say one thing with this model is it one of the best things that you can do is actually show that your model's wrong. Right. So it tells you, it's like, oh, wait, now I know something's not right. And in fact, it turns out that in science, that's the best thing to say. And then because it's always to say something's right just requires the right amount of tests and the right amount of efforts. But to say something's wrong is really useful, because actually that can actually completely save many, many people's times and hours and lives and careers and postdocs and PhDs if you can say, don't bother studying that because that's just not right. So I think that the model, it's proving a model right, proving a model wrong and right are equally quite important, I think, just as a small nugget on that.
Let's go to a slightly different topic. You're an American and you went to Europe to start your own lab, which is quite uncommon. Most people do it exactly the other way around. What was the motivation for you to do that, actually?
It was definitely not calculated from the beginning. So it was based on wanting to do a postdoc, which is the studies that you do after, obviously after doing your PhD. And that period of study, I wanted it to be outside of California, which is where I did everything. I always joke that I intended to go to New York, but the plane didn't stop and landed in London. But in fact, the real reason was is that there was someone I wanted to work with who was working in London. So and I thought that they were one of the best people in the field, and still think that they were for exactly what I wanted to do, was to understand how synapses worked in brain tissue. And so that's where I went to work and have benefited ever since. And then while I was there, I met a French woman, and then there was no reason to come back to the U.S. And fortunately, I was able to find a place to do work that at the level that I'd like to do it. And it's wonderful to live in Paris, so there's been no reason to come back. But you never know where life takes you.
If for any undergraduates or maybe graduate students or anybody else really interested in working in science, but abroad who are listening, and I pray that they are, it's a scary thing for an American to go to another country where, there's another language and everything like this. You know, a lot of the time we think that everybody comes here and they learn English because we live in the most international place and is the international language. But you're in Paris now. I mean, how does your lab work? Is it an English-speaking lab or a French-speaking lab? And when you go into something so technical, such a technical field, is it difficult to deal with people on that kind of, when you're not just dealing with regular language, you're dealing with science language?
Right. It's a great question. And I'm going to give an answer of not how it should be, but how it is in my lab, which is that my French is not as good as it can be. So everything ends up being in English, which because that is the international language of science at this time, has certain benefits for everyone. So I think everyone, even, French students, for example, apply to my lab, recognize the advantage of being in my lab because we speak largely English. And certainly because of my limitations in French, technical aspects indeed are going to be much more easy always in your native language. And so, and for me, fortunately, it's English. And so that is indeed true. But most people adapt. But at the same time, it can seem overwhelming to go into another country where there's the rest of your life is in another language. But oftentimes people adapt. I mean, I think our brains are adaptable. And if you have the right, the will and the necessity, and there are certain other countries, I mean, France, there's still the French language is a strong part of their culture. In other countries in Europe, they are more willing, they're more quickly willing or interested in speaking English. So it depends on, you can usually find a home even in France and other countries like Italy, but certainly like Germany and the Netherlands and things, they speak excellent English. So we can benefit from the fact that it's the international language in many things.
Thank you, David, for being here today and for giving us these exciting insights in the cerebellum, your work into computational models. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Max Planck Florida Institute's Neurotransmissions Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud and follow us on Facebook or Twitter at @neuropodcast to keep up to date.